Hello, everyone, and thank you so much for joining this telebriefing. My name is Matina Steves. I'm a reporter with the American newspaper, The Wall Street Journal. I'm based in Brussels, and I cover refugee and migration issues here in the European Union. I'll be moderating this call, and I'm very grateful to all of you for joining us. We hope that it will be very interesting, and indeed it's a very timely briefing to hold. Just let me get started with some house rules, as this is a telebriefing, so we're not able to see each other and make things a little easier. So we hope to carry on for the next hour. We are we're holding this call to discuss the release of a new Migration Policy Institute Europe brief entitled Strengthening Refugee Protection and Meeting Challenges, the European Union's Next Steps on Asylum. You can find that brief on MPI Europe's website, which is www.mpieurope.org. We hope to get as many questions from you as possible, and we've set aside about half an hour to address those questions. Please tweet your questions at Migration Policy or email them to communications@migrationpolicy.org at any point throughout this call, and we'll try and take on as many of these questions as possible. The reason why I said earlier that this is a good moment to be holding this briefing is because we're in the final stretch before European Union leaders meet here in Brussels at the end of June to hold a council that will adopt the strategic guidelines for the so-called Justice and Home Affairs portfolio. This may mean very little to those of you who are not conversant in EU speak, but basically this is a portfolio that includes asylum policy and refugee policy, a matter that's been incredibly prominent in the news agenda here in Europe. And so the fact that this is coming up just at the end of this month makes this call kind of timely, but it's not, certainly not coming out of nowhere. The news agenda in itself and the things that have been happening at Europe's borders for the last few months or even years have really prompted us to think about this as journalists, as experts, as academics. Basically, I'm sure if you're on this call, you will have seen news or read news or written about news of hundreds of migrants perishing at Europe's borders, especially the Mediterranean. You will have seen how Europe has had a real problem agreeing on how to handle refugees in particular, especially as conflict has been raging at its neighborhood, especially Syria, in fact, and now we're seeing Iraq flaring up again as well. These are factors that are pushing Europe's borders, but Europe internally has had a very difficult political agenda to deal with. We've seen the rise of far-right parties and xenophobic parties compounding and making the debate more toxic. So we're standing at a moment in time where we have terrible accidents and terrible incidents behind us happening almost every day, in particular around Italy, but also in the Aegean Sea between Turkey and Greece, of people trying to get into Europe. We're having a very serious refugee crisis at Europe's borders, and we're seeing Europe having formally this moment where it decides where it's going to take its strategy in terms of asylum and refugee policy, as well as the broader migration agenda, which has always been incredibly controversial and contentious here in the European Union. I can tell you for a fact from my own experience that traveling to European Union external borders to places like Lampedusa in Italy, or the northern border between Greece and Turkey in Evros, or the border Greek islands with Turkey and the Aegean, you see one reality, and that's the reality of under-resourced EU member states and huge numbers of refugees, migrants, economic migrants, arriving to Europe seeking a better future. If you move to the north of the continent, you see a different reality. You see countries that have more functioning asylum systems like Sweden, countries that are more generous like Germany, and countries that migrants and refugees have better chances of actually finding a job because these are economies that are doing much better than the south of the continent. that in and of itself creates a highly explosive situation here in Brussels, because the interests and problems that the northern countries and the southern countries face are just very different and pit them against each other very often. And all the while these things are being discussed, we see people still perishing and people still putting their lives at risk, and migrants and refugees paying huge sums of money to smugglers who take advantage of their weakness. I'll stop here and I'll hand over to Elizabeth Collette, who is the director at the Migration Policy Institute Europe. And just a brief reminder that we're looking forward to getting your questions either via tweet to @migrationpolicy or via email to communications@migrationpolicy.org. Liz?
Great. Thanks very much, Matilda, especially for setting out the realities on the ground, which I think many in Brussels can find themselves detached from. I think you've set out one of the core challenges already, which is the EU member states and the EU institutions are tasked with finding a long-term strategy in a context where the short-term exigencies of responding to crisis are almost overwhelming. We're at the beginning of a new policy cycle within the EU, and these strategic guidelines in their infancy when first conceptualized last year within the European Union were intended to be short, intended to be visionary, offering insight into the future ambitions of the European Union. I think now, looking at the current context, there are some serious questions over whether those strategic guidelines will actually be visionary and ambitious. It's likely to be a much more conventional document that's focused on keeping the train on the tracks rather than speeding the train up or, in fact, going into a new direction. So one of the questions I want to set out, my goal here is to offer some broad context and background for the development of immigration policy at EU level overall, and then hand over to Madeleine for a much more specific discussion about the asylum context here. This is the strategic guidelines have come at the end of 15 years of work within the justice and home affairs field. There have been three consecutive five-year programs, the Tampere program, the Hague program, and most recently the Stockholm program. The Tampere program was indeed one of those grand visions. It occurred at a unique moment within the EU, which was designed to embed a brand new policy area, justice and home affairs, within the EU architecture. As such, it articulated broad goals. Many of those goals have since become obsolete, but the appeal of the grand vision still remains. So, unfortunately, over time, these programs have become less effective, and the Stockholm program itself has been much less effective than its predecessors. It's fallen foul to the messy realities of developing policy at the EU level, and it's worth investigating a little about what exactly those realities have been for Stockholm, because they're likely to endure for future policymakers in the coming years. Some of the things that have been challenging with respect to the policy process itself has been the fact that finding a common denominator amongst 15 member states and then 25 member states, then 27 and now 28 member states has been difficult. All of these member states come from a very, very different historical, political, economic, and migration history. They understand immigration in very, very different ways. So common concepts developed at EU level had to be implemented at national level, and many of those member states chose to interpret their own national version of an EU concept rather than sticking to a common concept writ large. So given that, it's been harder to move beyond baseline policy, baseline harmonization of policy. Thus, during the Stockholm program, EU policy got more operational, which in turn became more technically challenging. With development of IT systems, how do you find the same technical details in all 28 member states to allow an IT system to function carefully across all 28. At the same time, as I say, the proliferation of actors has been key. Not only the enlargement and successive enlargement of member states, but also the involvement of additional EU institutions, notably the European Parliament. Over the last 5 years, the Lisbon Treaty has given the European Parliament a much stronger role in adapting and deciding on EU policy, which is, in some cases, qualitatively improved that policy, but also lengthened the policy process itself. The most recently concluded directives on legal migration have been 8 years in the making since they were first conceived in 2005, and that demonstrates how long the policy process has become at EU level. And in turn, developing at the same time, member states have developed their own national policy on immigration to respond to particular political and empirical realities, which has further complicated their engagement at EU level. But beyond the process, there are some broader issues at stake. There has been an overall chill across Europe amongst policymakers, politicians, and publics towards immigration and asylum policy. This has a number of drivers. First is the rise of sort of populist and far-right groups in the public debate and their visibility with respect to not just immigration skepticism, but skepticism to the European project overall and its relative value to each member state. At the same time, thinking through the effects of the economic crisis, at a time of great vulnerability for many young unemployed across Europe, immigrants have found themselves disproportionately represented in many of these populations in the unemployment lines, and has created a great vulnerability amongst that group, but also questions as to whether further immigration to the EU is the correct strategy, even though overall the European Union is facing a looming demographic crisis. But finally, one of the things that has affected Stockholm deeply, and I think this speaks to the asylum situation more specifically, are that geopolitical shocks and events over the past 5 years have derailed many of the actions envisaged under the Stockholm program. The situation on the Greek border in 2010-2011, the realization that the Greek government had not implemented the asylum acquis to the extent that other countries had expected them to, reduced mutual trust across the European Union and meant that most member states were focused on finding a solution for Greece at a time of extraordinary economic crisis, rather than focus on the day-to-day development of EU policy. At the same time, particular external events, such as the Arab Spring, demonstrate how the EU can often forget about the outside and instead worry about the internal politics of the EU. The Arab Spring precipitated a movement of Tunisian migrants to Italy. The Italian government then gave them visas, and many of those migrants traveled on through to France. In retaliation, in response to this, the French government decided to shut down internal borders between France and Italy. This precipitated a much broader debate amongst member states about the rules of internal border control and the Schengen governance overall. And the Schengen system is the system whereby internal border controls have been removed within the EU. The corollary to that is the EU is only as strong as its strongest external border and most robust immigration policy. It exemplifies the core challenges for European Union member states. They may wish to address external issues, but find themselves constantly worrying about the internal security issues at the same time. This, if I can call it, navel-gazing approach of the EU has often derailed a more forward-looking, long-term approach to engagement with third countries and dealing with external situations. So where does this leave the EU? Well, over the next 5 years, I think we'll see a focus on less on new policy and legislation and much more on operational coordination and consolidation and implementation. There's a feeling that there's been enough policy right now. Now's the time to implement and make sure it's implemented correctly. Well, is this enough? In the face of an intractable crisis, there's a need for further and deeper consideration as to how the European Union can address critical humanitarian situations and continued mixed flows across the Mediterranean. There is a need for a way out of the solidarity standoff, if you can call it that, which is more in the heads of northern and southern member states than perhaps exists in reality. There will be a need for the strategic guidelines to go deeper, even though they won't likely do so. And thus, MPI, along with the Open Society Foundations and led by Madeleine Garlick, are going to spend the next 2 to 3 years looking more deeply at the situation with the common European asylum system within Europe, understanding where and how EU member states and various institutions can work more closely, more collaboratively, and more deeply on some of these critical issues and hopefully find a resolution for that. And with that, I'd like to hand over to Madeleine.
Thank you so much, Liz. This is Matina again. Just to introduce Madeleine Garlick properly, Madeleine is a fellow of the International Migration Institute of the Open Society Foundations, and she is currently working on the asylum project that Liz mentioned with MPI Europe. She's also the author of the brief that we mentioned earlier, strengthening refugee protection and meeting challenges, the European Union's next steps on asylum. A reminder that you can find that on www.mpieurope.org. And just to urge you again to tweet us your questions to @migrationpolicy and email them to communications@migrationpolicy.org. We really look forward to getting those. And without further ado, over to Madeline.
Thank you, Martina and Liz, and also to all of those taking part from abroad. In answer to the question that has been posed in this event's title, I think we can say no. It's not the case that EU asylum and migration policy has comprehensively failed, certainly not as yet, but it does need to succeed with better results and greater impact in the future. And now really, as Liz and Martina have highlighted, is an important moment and in many ways a key test for the EU and for member states in their efforts to really develop an effective common policy on asylum and migration that can deliver the results that are needed. Some of the challenges that it faces right now are going to reveal its ability to ensure that refugees can receive protection where they are the EU's responsibility, while at the same time managing migration in an effective and sustainable way. I think looking back, it's worth also recalling that there has been significant progress that's been made in the course of development of this policy so far, since 1999, when member states first transferred legal competence for asylum, migration and borders from the national to the EU level. Some important steps have been taken. We now have, at EU level, common laws and standards that have been adopted. There are asylum procedures that have been established along broadly harmonised lines with certain minimum safeguards that were not there in place in many member states before. There are systems now in place to receive asylum seekers in decent conditions, recalling that some member states didn't have laws or facilities in place to house and feed asylum seekers in the past. And member states are under positive obligations to determine claims and provide protection. But it's clear, nonetheless, despite all of those efforts, that there are some very serious challenges that are being faced in practice. We see a situation today where there are wide divergences in practice in the way member states apply the supposedly common laws and criteria for protection. We also see that some member states' asylum systems have failed to function altogether at various times in the past. And the most well-known example of that is Greece, where the European Court of Human Rights found in 2011 that asylum seekers were suffering serious human rights violations and were at risk of being expelled to face persecution. We see also there are a number of people who try to gain access to EU territory to seek protection today who are pushed back at borders or face other obstacles that prevent them from claiming protection and having a fair assessment of their claims. And we also see a number of member states that are under very significant strain because of the numbers of arrivals with which they can't cope, and the system for distributing asylum seekers amongst member states, which is said to exacerbate those perceived imbalances and demands. So this then is a key moment because after 15 years it's really crucial to find a solution to these ongoing problems, a solution that has to involve implementation of the agreed rules and policies in good faith, in line with the EU's committed shared goals to ensure protection pursuant to international law and a spirit of solidarity amongst the member states. But it's also going to be a crucial moment because we are going to see a global situation and a likelihood that it's going to bring significant more demands in future. While at least some of those who come irregularly to Europe and enter the asylum system may be coming for reasons other than the risk of persecution, there are many who are refugees who are fleeing serious harm, human rights violations and persecutions in the sense of the international conventions that define this. And the Syria situation is really a prime example of this today. We have 2.9 million refugees who have fled from Syria over the last 2 years into the neighbouring countries. By comparison, less than 100,000 people have come from Syria to the EU to seek protection. It's correct that that number in Europe is likely to mount with no end in sight to the crisis, and it's likely the growing pressures on host countries in the region, including Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan and Iraq, are going to increase that likelihood. We also see, as Martina mentioned, Iraq, which is itself the scene of bloody fighting and displacement, which has the potential to escalate and result in more people coming to Europe. and other situations worldwide, including potentially Ukraine if the situation escalates, ongoing situations in Afghanistan and Somalia and others that mean that people are going to come and continue to demand protection of Europe in line with its international commitments. So given these pressures, it seems that there is going to be an increasing need for Europe to look at ways to ensure that those people who are refugees are going to be able to access territory and protection where they're going to be able to enjoy their legal rights. People such as this can't be classified as people making unfounded claims in a mixed migration flow that can or should be stemmed outside the Europeans' borders. Thus, the EU needs to be ready to ensure that it's equipped to use the asylum instruments and place and arrangements it's put there for their intended purpose. So for these and other reasons, it's really crucial that the forthcoming strategic guidelines will lay a strong foundation for future action and further evolution of the common European asylum system so that it will be able to meet current challenges but also to adapt to changing needs and situations over time. In the policy brief published by MPI, we sought to provide a basis and some substantive material for reflection for those involved in the negotiating process. We've also set out a series of recommendations on how the opportunity could be utilised through this process to define strategic, shared goals and ways forward. For us, the strategic guidelines need to be guided by long-term thinking, by realism and ambition. It can't be the case that immediate, populist, nationally focused agendas solely determine the outcome or all those involved are going to see a less effective result. We hope that politicians and policymakers are going to be ready to demonstrate their commitment to the objective of establishing an asylum system that works in the interests of all member states as well as those people who are seeking protection in Europe. So we've made a series of recommendations. I'll mention a few of those, perhaps the key ones that might be of interest today. Firstly, we're calling upon the EU to affirm its commitment to strengthen the implementation of existing EU laws. And this is going to require continuing and increasing practical cooperation between member states on asylum. There needs to be continued investment in work that has already been started, notably under the coordination of the European Asylum Support Office, including in the areas of developing common training tools for officials, shared country of origin resources, exchange of information and practice, as well as putting in place quality assurance mechanisms in all member states' asylum systems. It's also going to require more engagement by all member states in such activities, but also cooperation with the European Fundamental Rights Agency, with key civil society organisations who have proven their expertise and readiness and ability to contribute to the running of asylum systems in Europe, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees and others. It requires better monitoring of practice at national level, as well as readiness by the European Commission to enforce the EU standards through court actions for infringement where needed. A second key area we've identified is the need to ensure a reiteration of the ongoing commitment of the EU to the principle of solidarity and responsibility sharing on asylum. Solidarity is needed because on asylum there are obligations and challenges which are shared amongst the member states as well as those which affect some member states much more than others. This isn't about a division between northern and southern EU member states in many respects. The reality is that pressures and failures to manage arrivals in one place at the external border, which includes not only sea frontiers but also land and air borders, and that this can affect other states in different parts of the Union with consequences for all. All member states would acknowledge that they have a shared interest in ensuring the full and effective operation of national asylum systems. But on the other hand, it's important also to ensure that we have an arrangement that not only provides support to the operation of those national systems, but also strong incentives to states to use every effort to invest in their own systems and make certain they function well as a national priority. Solidarity amongst EU states and taking responsibility for fulfilling one's own national obligations are not incompatible goals. In fact, they should support each other. There also may be a need in the longer term to rethink existing arrangements for allocation of responsibility for asylum claims amongst states under the EU's Dublin Regulation, either in specific situations as the courts have demanded in the past or more broadly. A third key area to highlight is that of cooperation between the EU and other third non-EU countries, including those that host substantial refugee populations, as well as those through which asylum seekers transit en route to Europe. And this can't be about containing or dumping asylum seekers in those countries through stricter border control, or otherwise those states are going to simply see no interest for them in cooperating. It's important to recall that many of them, including today in the Middle East and North Africa, are hosting exponentially more refugees in the EU with far fewer resources. Resettlement is one way for the EU to do more in this respect. This means offering places for refugees to come to Europe from first host countries where those refugees are not safe or can't find a solution there. The EU at present contributes less than 10% of global resettlement places, far behind countries such as Australia, Canada, and the US. A fourth key area that we have highlighted is that of integration of refugees and other people granted protection. This is a major ongoing challenge, including in member states that struggle with economic and social concerns these days. Strong leadership at EU and national level is needed to reiterate the importance of the contribution that people who have been granted protection can make to their host societies in order to enable them to integrate and to be able to contribute at the earliest possible stage. Not all of these challenges, of course, can be dealt with in the strategic guidelines alone. It's going to require a sustained effort, as well as creative thinking and engagement at political and technical level in the EU and member states for years to come. Our project, operated now by MPI and IMI, aims to continue to explore some of these and other important issues for further development on policies and practice in this area, and to try and provoke thinking on how to move forward in a principled and practical way. I look forward to questions, comments, and discussion further on this amongst our participants today. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Madeline. Before I get started with your questions, just a brief summary of what we've heard and my 5 cents too. But please do continue to tweet your questions to @migrationpolicy. Or email them to communications@migrationpolicy.org. I think what Liz and Madeline have done here is they've given us a 360 view about why it is so incredibly challenging to forge common EU migration policy and how it becomes even more challenging to do so at times of economic hardship in Europe, like we've had in the past 5 years of recession, at times of more and more conflict at Europe's borders, and at times when these things become compounded with internal political issues. When Liz described the incredibly long policy process at Brussels level and how that conflicts with national policies, because member states in the European Union have seen migration as something extremely politically sensitive and have not always being keen to introduce common policy for that, and how these things just clash and become ever more complicated. And she also spoke about this chill across Europe with everything that has to do with migration. I'm sure I'm not saying anything particularly wise here. This has just been worsened and worsened in the context of higher unemployment rates and shrinking economic output in several European Union member states, and in particular, the unfortunate fact that these countries that were at the forefront of the Eurozone economic crisis also often happen to be European Union external borders. And in that respect, I'm thinking especially of Greece. And then Madeline really laid out very well how just the situation at Europe's borders is at the moment creating a perfect storm for refugee policy here. It's the Syria conflict in and of itself, and the huge numbers of displaced people and refugees because of that would have been enough to just make things very difficult and stretch a system that's not functioning very well in Europe. But on top of that, we're seeing a constantly deteriorating situation in Eritrea and the broader Horn of Africa. We're seeing Eritreans topping the list of nationalities arriving to the EU through the Mediterranean and Italy, which is rather extraordinary considering how small Eritrea is, but really speaks to the conditions in the Horn of Africa. We have the situation in Libya. Libya has always been
a port of departure for migrants and refugees wishing to arrive in the European Union. But the incredible volatility of in Libya has meant that we're now hearing of thousands or even hundreds of thousands of refugees and migrants stuck in Libya, stuck in Tripoli, abused, and still wanting to come to Europe. Iraq is a country that the European Union has dealt with before in terms of the refugee displacement and the and people trying to arrive here, and the rapid deterioration of the situation in Iraq and the radical displacement of what appeared to be hundreds of thousands of people every day since conflict escalated there will surely wash up on Europe's shores. So the conditions at the moment really are creating this perfect storm. But Madeleine said something very telling when she outlined the paper's recommendations for this policy dialogue. The first thing she said was that the EU should affirm its commitment to existing EU law. So while there's clearly a challenge that requires a kind of broader and deeper and more radical vision and possibly, you know, policy experimentation and policy innovation in the area of refugees and migrants in general, we're in a political situation within the European Union where states are so stretched when it comes to migration that even affirming their commitment to law they've already got in place is crucial. It's key, and it's not a given. So once we start with that, then we can see where the debate will take us. I think that's it for me. And just let me get straight into your questions. Again, sorry to repeat myself. Please do keep tweeting them to @migrationpolicy or emailing them to communications@migrationpolicy.org. Now, one question I can see here is the following. Considering the heavy burden placed on European Union's southern Mediterranean member states like Italy and Spain and Greece, do our experts envision a way to share the burden among the southern and northern European countries in controlling the EU common southern borders and setting immediate humanitarian help for migrants and asylum seekers? So is there a way that, for example, you can have a situation where Germany and other northern European countries are helping Greece and Italy guard or manage their external borders? Okay, I don't think Liz is there. Madeleine, are you able to answer that question?
Yes, happy to, Martina. Yes, the question asks whether or not there is prospects of solidarity in the field, not only of asylum, but also controlling borders. And I think we do have an expressed readiness that's been reiterated in policies in the past amongst member states to work together also on managing their borders. They've established an EU agency, Frontex, that has responsibility to that, and recently adopted a significant amount of EU funding for the coming years to enable states that needs additional resources to help them in managing their borders to draw on that to do so. Importantly, from a refugee protection perspective, those border policies, laws and instruments are also subject to international requirements and to European Union laws, which say that there needs to be safeguards in there for people who might arrive at borders and who need international protection and ask for asylum when they arrive at those borders. Solidarity is actually a key theme which pervades discussions across a number of areas in the asylum, migration and border fields. It's an obligation, in fact, under the EU treaty that was adopted in 2009, the Lisbon Treaty. What is challenging about it is that there are very different visions of what the word solidarity and the principle of fair sharing of responsibility actually mean in practice. Some states who feel that they are under extreme pressure because of their locations on the external frontiers of the borders feel that they are particularly deserving and needy of solidarity. Other states in Northern and Western Europe point to the fact that in terms of absolute numbers, those states receive far more asylum seekers than those along the external frontiers. In fact, it's something close to 60% of all asylum claims that were lodged in the EU in 2013 were lodged in four member states that were in the northern part of Europe: Sweden, France, Germany, and the UK. So there is a serious discussion that needs to take place, including in the framework of work on the strategic guidelines, on how to put this solidarity principle into practice and how to ensure that those states that need assistance are going to be able to receive it. I think what we are aware of here too is that there is at least some suggestion that some states need to be doing more in order to try and fulfill their obligations from their own resources alone before calling on others for help and support and solidarity. And it seems likely that there's going to be an outcome from this discussion that is going to underline that states do need to do what they can to comply with their obligations to the extent possible, but that they should also be able to call upon the EU for support and solidarity where that is needed. And there are many ways in which this can be provided: funding through emergency or other budget lines, resources seconded to member states for the purpose of helping them to strengthen parts of their asylum systems, for example, support from the European Asylum Support Office, which has been developed specifically for this purpose. So this is a key discussion that needs to take place over the next few weeks and is going to really also determine to a certain extent how solidarity will be implemented in practice in the years to come, and whether or not then EU asylum systems are going to be able to function in the optimal way that they need to ensure people who need protection will get it.
Thanks so much for tackling that, Madeline, so convincingly. One thing I would add to that is just from a kind of a news angle, if you will, Frontex is mentioned a lot in the context of common border management. Frontex is a very small European Union agency. It's based in Warsaw. It doesn't actually own resources, so it doesn't own boats or other or radars or anything like that. Really, it has a coordinating role for EU border management forces. But one of the very interesting things about Frontex is that it has a very tiny budget, which they decry constantly. And in fact, just about 6 weeks ago, the Frontex deputy chief was here in Brussels, gave a press conference at which he explained to the press that despite commitment to strengthen the search and rescue operations, especially in the Mediterranean, Frontex's budget has been stuck at exactly the same level for the next 5 years as it was in the previous 5 years. So even after the big accidents, the big shipwrecks, the tragedies in Lampedusa, Frontex's budget remains a fraction of what the EU dedicates to, say, subsidizing rice and other crop agriculture here in Europe. So there is a big debate around the issue of funding and budget, and that's definitely something that the southern European states in particular are pressing on. Moving on from the borders, there is a related question about the Dublin Agreement, which one of the people who joined in the celebrating of posed, which I think is very interesting. Is, do you envisage an amendment of the Dublin Convention establishing that asylum seekers must seek asylum in the first EU member state in which they enter? Liz, are you back with us? Oh, you're back. Okay. Hi, Liz. You heard the Dublin question?
I did.
Okay, great. It's over to you.
I can leave Madeline to fill in the details, but I think I can say from the point of view that the politics of this, you know, the difficulty renegotiating Dublin the last time around, third and what probably won't be, but everyone hopes will be the last time around, has left everyone in a situation of political exhaustion. So now there is a period that the very strong message from everyone is, well, let's implement this and see if it works, and we can review this in a few years' time if it doesn't. Now, there are varying opinions on whether that would actually be, whether the reformed version of Dublin will work in practice. But I think, you know, it's always worth when understanding the sort of technical issues associated with the asylum system and the solidarity principle to understand the politics of this as well. There is a certain psychological standoff between EU member states, north and south, and going back to the previous question, you know, member states, in many member states, this issue is a political issue that plays in the media in a number of countries. So to be seen to be being weak on the EU stage on an issue of solidarity and burden sharing is a no-go for a number of different member states. And I think, you know, finding ways to put the solidarity principle in practice is important, because reducing the politics and the political impetus around it, I think, is going to be key to ultimately finding a resolution as well. And Madeline, I don't know if you want to add anything on the Dublin side.
Yes, certainly, Liz. No, I would have to agree with you, absolutely. There's been now three attempts by the European Union member states to put in place a system under the Dublin arrangements which could work. And having reaffirmed its basic principles in the recast regulation that was agreed last June, it's hard to imagine that states are going to be ready to turn around and admit that it hasn't worked and that they need to go back and amend it substantially any time very, very soon. That being said, it's very clear that there are a number of very significant challenges that this system creates in practice. And there's been a number of important reports over the years by ECRE, by Jesuit Refugee Service and others, that have documented some of these challenges, as well as the impact it's had on many individual asylum seekers who have waited for months or years in this system before their claim even starts to be assessed. We also understand that there are a number of significant challenges around its implementation that probably mean it's not working for states in all senses in the way that they would want it to do. Figures indicate that there is only around 25% of all Dublin cases in which transfers actually take place. This means that there's a very long and complicated and costly bureaucracy that's in place, whereas those people who actually finally are sent back to other states who are deemed to be responsible are only a very small fraction of those who are put through the system. The European Commission is required under Dublin to conduct a review of the regulation and its application by mid-2016. So there will be an opportunity then for the EU member states, the Council and the Parliament, to assess again whether or not it's time to look at that system once more. And it is distinctly possible that, in light of the experiences that have been observed over the last few years and some further examination that we know that the Commission and others are foreseeing, that there might be the potential to look again at key features of that system if it is seen indeed, as some would argue now, to be something that really achieves the reverse of solidarity and fair sharing of responsibility.
Thank you, Madeline. I think I've got another question for you, just to move away a little bit from the more technical discussion. One of the people who are with us in this briefing has asked this. The Arab Spring and the conflict in Syria have triggered more migration. But I'm wondering how much and how EU policy, both in Brussels and among individual countries, has contributed to the humanitarian crisis today.
Thank you, Martina. It's a very broad question that raises many issues. And I think it's clearly articulating something that some people would argue that there are a number of the EU's policies, including notably in its dealings with other countries, which have contributed to situations which lead to displacement in some circumstances. And this might include some policies relating to foreign relations, political alliances, perhaps to trade, which has impacts on local economies in some countries, which in turn has impacts on people's ability to sustain their livelihood. It's nonetheless also important in that discussion to bear in mind that there are many policies of the European Union that have also brought very direct and substantial help to people in situations of humanitarian need worldwide. And I'm thinking here particularly around humanitarian aid to conflict and emergency situations. If we look at the Syria situation, for example, the EU and the member states together are by far the biggest donors to the UN's efforts to assist Syrians, both within Syria suffering displacement, as well as those who are refugees outside. The EU, of course, also undertakes extensive development assistance, as well as institution building in various countries in order to try and help those countries to perhaps put in place stable and secure systems and economies that can avert the need for people to move abroad. In terms of the EU's responses at within its borders as well, there I think it's correct, though, we have to acknowledge that there has been a mixed picture. There are policies which do aim to ensure that there is maximum respect for human rights, access to asylum amongst other fundamental rights, and humane responses to the needs also of irregular migrants who are not refugees. But as we've all indicated in the course of discussion today, there are some very significant problems in practice in how all of that is played out. And the result is that in some cases, policies within and at the EU's borders don't necessarily mean that people who have humanitarian needs as well as legal protection needs are able to see those needs addressed and are able to get protection for their rights to the extent that's really crucial. So this has to be an ongoing process for the European Union, and more is needed to invest to ensure that these systems can be made to work better.
Thank you, Madeline. Liz, I think this one's for you. There's a question here. Do you think that the results of the European Parliament elections will have an impact on the ambition of the strategic guidelines?
That is a good question. My answer would be that I think the anticipated results of the European election has an effect on the strategic guidelines even before the election. I think we've seen a lowering in sort of political ambition with respect to strategic guidelines for some time, certainly from the beginning of the year. And I think there's also, you know, it's also a situation where the EU wants to normalize a debate about EU immigration policy rather than hit on political sensitivities. Now, that could be a smart thing to do at a time when there are a number of sort of noisy actors raising everything to do with the EU and immigration. But it does leave the EU somewhat unanchored in terms of an ambitious future program. I think we'll see a strategic guidelines that is sort of tempered by a very middle of the road, this is what we're going to do, nothing particularly out of the ordinary, and just really a consolidation program. And I think we'll see that political chill will also spread to member states who will be thinking about how they pitch future immigration policy reform in the coming years in a changed context.
Thanks so much, Liz. Another one for Madeline. Madeline, what are your recommendations, asks our friend who's on this call, regarding vulnerable groups of migrants or refugees, especially unaccompanied minors, refugee children who arrive alone at the EU borders, and how are their rights best realized within the context of the strategic guidelines?
Thank you, Martina. Yes, I think there a recommendation regarding more effective implementation of safeguards and provisions that have been agreed is absolutely crucial. We saw in the course of amendments to the EU laws that were agreed in June of last year a number of really crucial new provisions that have been adopted, which do provide for greater protection for the rights of people who are vulnerable, who have specific needs, and particular provisions relating to the rights of unaccompanied children as well. These related to two main areas, firstly that of reception, meaning the provisions that govern conditions in which asylum seekers have to be held and the treatment that they have to receive while they're waiting for an outcome of their claim. And in there is a whole set of new provisions that have been adopted, which provides that people who have so-called special reception needs must have those needs identified, first of all, in the course of the asylum procedure, and secondly, addressed with provision of necessary treatment, support, counselling, or other facilities as needed. There are also special safeguards relating to people who have special procedural needs. So those who are in the asylum procedure, who are in the course of undergoing interviews and claim examination, and who may not be able necessarily to undertake that process effectively without additional special assistance, counselling, and other forms of support. These provisions, in that connection, I should also mention that both of those instruments, as well as others, also received changes which have reaffirmed the importance of ensuring the best interests of the child, which relates also to unaccompanied children in the asylum procedure. And this concept of best interests of the child comes from the Convention on the Rights of the Child It's something that all member states are bound by, but it's been evident in the past that not all asylum-seeking children have been able to benefit from the safeguards that that convention provides. And so some of these changes in the legislation are designed to ensure that these will be more effectively honoured in practice in the future. It's no secret, I think, that these were difficult provisions to negotiate. There were a number of member states who were very concerned that these might open the potential for so-called abuse, meaning effectively that people would purport to have special needs when perhaps they might not, in fact, that might not be the case. And there was also concern that this was going to involve the potential for significant delays or costs in the asylum procedure. But nonetheless, they have been adopted with particular support from the Commission, from some member states and the Parliament. So the crucial challenge now is to ensure that these are going to be effectively implemented in practice. And this is going to mean that the states that don't have the tools to be able to identify and effectively provide help to people with special needs, including unaccompanied children, are going to need to request that from the EU level. They're going to need to receive those resources. They're going to need to work with other states who have good practice in order to try and develop that in their own context. And this is going to be absolutely essential, and it's something which we hope will be closely monitored and documented, including by the many expert observers and civil society organisations in the field who follow these issues closely.
Thanks so much, Madeline. I think we have time for just another couple of questions. There's one quite specific question regarding the Dublin regulation. The question is, the new Dublin regulation includes an early warning and preparedness mechanism. Do you have any insight as to how this is working in practice up to now? Liz or Madeline, either of you want to answer that?
Well, I can perhaps mention that indeed the early warning mechanism has been hailed as one of the most important innovations in the amendments to the Dublin system. It's early days to assess in full its impact in practice until now, but we do know that the European Asylum Support Office has already put in place a number of tools and processes that are designed to ensure that this is going to enable the EU to identify in advance problems that are emerging in a particular state's asylum systems and to take early action in order to try and prevent that situation evolving into a full-scale crisis of the kind that we have seen in Greece and to a lesser extent, more recently also in Bulgaria. What we know is that the European Asylum Support Office is seeking to gather quite extensive amounts of information and to include these in reports, some of which are publicly available. The EASO on its website has a number of quarterly reports in which it reports on trends, developments and asylum flows. There is also going to be the European Asylum Support Office's next annual report that will come out at the beginning of July, which is also going to document some of the strengths and weaknesses of asylum in practice in a number of member states. The crucial question is going to be whether or not there's going to be readiness and willingness on the part of EU member states and institutions to speak frankly and openly about problems that are emerging in a way that's going to enable them to be tackled effectively. There is historically a great deal of sensitivity amongst member states about criticising each other. We hope that there's going to be enough readiness, given what's at stake here, in this case, to really use this early warning mechanism effectively and properly and to take the steps that are needed to make sure that such crises don't develop and run out of control at an early stage.
All right. Thanks, Madeline. I think there's one question that seems to be particularly apt for the concluding question of this telebriefing. And it would be great if Liz could tackle it and then Madeline also respond to it so we can conclude our call. The question is this. Given the habit of member states to use migration and asylum issues as political leverage in domestic politics, is the principle of solidarity that drives much of the forward movement on the long-term future of the common European asylum system doomed to eternal oscillation between what the EU would hope for in terms of common policy and what national politicians need to win votes at home? Liz?
Oh, that's a billion-dollar question. I think this is where you'll see how Madeline and I make a good team, because I'm the eternal cynic. So I look at the national debates in some countries, and I see how important the solidarity principle is to those debates, particularly places such as Greece, Malta, Italy. And you can there see how any kind of movement on solidarity issues resonates in the national press and with the opposition parties. This idea that we must get more help, we shouldn't give, can create a kind of standoff situation in any member state. So in that sense, perhaps it is doomed. But I am heartened by the fact that the Italian government embarked on the Mare Nostrum operation, which was an operation that cost them 9 million euros a month, to go out and do search and rescue in the Mediterranean. Now, they received some support from the European Union for that, but it's, for me, one of those types of acts of faith which is very important in terms of moving an agenda forward by saying, we are going to take an important step, now we're going to ask you to take an important step. And in view of the upcoming Italian presidency, it's going to be interesting to see whether the Italian government chooses to use their investment into Mare Nostrum to gain political capital on the European stage. There has been a slight change in the national dynamics in Italy with the new Prime Minister Renzi, and so there might be a change in dynamic in Italy that could have a knock-on effect to other countries. I remain a cynic, but I remain a hopeful cynic.
All right, thanks, Liz. Madeline?
Yes, thanks for this one, Martina. No, I'd have to say I do hope I could take a more optimistic view on this one. Yes, it's true. We see challenges in this one, and it does seem to be something where domestic interests often are extremely strong in dominating politicians' responses. But the principle of solidarity, as articulated in the treaties and in other parts of EU law also, does imply that there is at base a shared interest in trying to forge common action at European Union level. And this was actually the whole idea that underlay the creation of common asylum, migration and border policies when the enterprise began in 1999. With free movement across borders within the European Union, member states agreed that it was crucial for them to adopt consistent and united approaches to the treatment of people who did manage to enter the European Union through its external borders and to treat them in a consistent way. That shared interest, I think, really is very much in evidence today. The fact the response of some member states does have impacts on others. Failures, inabilities by some member states to deal with arrivals within their own territories does have consequences for others. So the important thing is going to be to ensure that politicians are going to feel encouraged to take the longer-term view and not necessarily to respond only to the demands of populism and to short-term domestic concerns, but really look at what is in the interests of their countries as well as the European Union as a whole and asylum seekers and refugees in the longer term.
Madeline, thank you so much. And with that, thank you all for participating in this telebriefing. Reminding you that you can find the latest MPI Europe policy brief, Strengthening Refugee Protection and Meeting Challenges, on MPI Europe's website, www.mpieurope.org. Liz Collette, Madeline Garlick, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Martina.
Thank you, Martina.
For more information about MPI Europe, please visit www.mpireurope.org.